Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com, The Tea Party, the Debt Ceiling, and White Southern Extremism. He believes the mainstream media have missed the story, portraying the Tea Party movement in ideological terms rather than regional terms. And while Minnesota's Michelle Bachmann and Illinois' Joe Walsh are the face of the party, the majority of its members in the House of Representatives are white Southern men. Then James Carville joins us. He is a veteran political strategist who helped elect President Bill Clinton twice and is a contributor to CNN. Having described the White House's handling of the Republican-manufactured debt ceiling crisis as a rout from the beginning, James Carville offers up some optimism in terms of an election strategy for the Democrats in 2012, now that John Boehner has proclaimed he got 98% of what he wanted out of the deal. It's Boehner's economy, and just like Harry Truman ran against a do-nothing Congress, Carville argues Obama should run against an all-cuts, no-taxes-on-the-billionaires Boehner Congress. Then we'll get an overseas perspective on how the recently self-inflicted wound to America's economy compares to the very real economic distress in Europe as the Greek crisis migrates to Spain and Italy. Amy Verdun, an expert on European politics at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, joins us. Then finally, now that a determined minority has set the economic course of the nation that is bound to inflict further pain on the many while continuing to reward the few, Jeff Madrick, the author of Age of Greed, joins us to assess the victory of greed over governance. Joining us now is Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. He has an article at Salon.com called The Tea Party, the Debt Ceiling, and White Southern Extremism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Well, thank you for having me on, Ian.
And I suppose I understand, although it's hard to grasp, why the Tea Party, or how the Tea Party movement managed to mobilize the anger of people who found their standard of living declining and somehow channeled it into a campaign to make them worse. And I understand, I suppose, why Rupert Murdoch is able to persuade his viewers of Fox News to vote against their own interest in favor of his. But I don't understand how this predominantly Southern movement is able to campaign and get votes demanding less tax for billionaires and worse health, education, and Social Security for themselves.
Well, I would challenge your premise. I think you're unwittingly falling into the trap of attributing the Tea Party movement to a bunch of ordinary, alienated, largely working-class Americans who are upset by the Great Recession and by the policy responses and are looking for scapegoats. If that were the actual case, if Tea Party were just alienated middle Americans, you would expect an even geographic spread of Tea Party members and also their representatives in Congress. So what I discovered, not entirely to my surprise when I did the numbers, was that if you look only at the House Tea Party Caucus, which is not necessarily representative of all sympathizers of the Tea Party in the country, but it tells you something. These are members of the House of Representatives willing to identify themselves as Tea Party members. 63% are from the South, 19% from the Midwest. The West, the Mountain West, is about 16%. And then technically they're 2% from the Northeast, but that includes a representative from Maryland, which is more or less a southern state, even though it wasn't part of the Confederacy. So clearly what's going on here is a cultural clash between the South and a lot of the Midwestern and Western states and the rest of the country. And I should add that if you count border states, that is, states on the border of the South with large southern populations, then much of your Midwestern Tea Party membership actually should be added to the Southern membership, and you end up with about 75% or three-quarters of House Tea Party members being either from the South or Southern border states. So this is about regional ideology. It's not simply anger on the part of Americans upset with the economic crisis.
So, Michael Lind, if it's not working Americans voting against their own interests, What are the interests then of this Southern-dominated movement?
Well, you can argue that it's against their interests. After all, the South has done very poorly for most middle class and working class and poor Southerners, you know, for two centuries, white and black and Latino alike. So you can still make that argument. But my point was, you have to connect not only the goal of slashing government, at least the federal government, but also the method of trying to bring the federal government crashing to a halt, to a tradition of Southern obstructionism and intransigence that goes all the way back to the 1790s, as I point out, when in the Kentucky resolutions, Kentucky and Virginia claimed that states could nullify federal legislation they didn't like. And in my article, I'm not going to repeat it here, but I go through the whole history of crises over slavery, the Civil War, of course, massive resistance to desegregation during the Civil Rights era. And I see this as part of a pattern. When the Northeast or the Midwest or California and the West Coast lose an election, or they gain one half of one third of the government, which is what the Republicans now control, at least of the three political branches, they don't threaten America's credit rating. They don't shut down the government. They don't just act that way. You know, so I think you have to look at the method as well as the kind of states' rights, traditional small government Southern conservatism as part of a very deeply rooted Southern political culture.
And you argue that this latest of a series of attacks on American democracy by the white Southern minority is a part of a two-century-long effort to paralyze, sabotage, or in the case of the Civil War, destroy American democracy in order to get their way.
When they don't control it, when they control the political branches of the federal government, my fellow Southerners, and I'm a Southerner, are perfectly content with sweeping uses of federal power and prerogative. Mm-hmm. It's only when they lose elections that they try to use their minority position within the government. Not simply, you know, obviously the Democrats as a minority and liberals, you know, engage in strategy too. I don't want to claim that they're blameless. But the sheer brinksmanship that you see of the Tea Party, I think, would be quite different even if the Tea Party caucus in the House were mostly New Englanders or people from the West Coast.
So explain to me, because the assumption's always been that the right side won the Civil War, but I'm trying to understand what motivates this kind of rage or this kind of guerrilla kind of approach to governance. I understand, I don't understand, but I'm curious to understand what makes white Southern men tick in as much as
the white Southern women as well.
And white Southern women, but going back to the Civil War,
right.
But going back to the Civil War, it seems to me that the white, ordinary white Southerners, the kind of people who vote for the Tea Party, the blacksmiths and carpenters, were ultimately fighting for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. I don't understand this, all that kind of right-to-work mentality. What drives it? Because everybody's not Ashley Wilkes and Rhett Butler.
Well, that's right, and there are actually two Souths. There's the coastal plantation South with large African-American populations, and that tended to be the most hierarchical and conservative and dominated by the planters during the slavery era and then landlords and big business since then. Then you have the Scots-Irish South. This is the Upland South or the Mountain South, the Appalachia and the Ozarks, all the way down to Texas. And traditionally, this has been a contested area. There have always been a great number of Scots-Irish populists up in the hills who dislike the Southern elites even more than they dislike the Yankees in New York and in Washington. And this is where progressives and liberals make a mistake, in my opinion. It'd be interesting to see what James Carville has to say. When Northern parties, Northern-based parties like Lincoln's Republicans during the Civil War have succeeded, they've always managed to lure away a number of these working-class or rural upland Southern whites away from the Southern oligarchy. And I'm afraid that a lot of progressives and liberals, when they simply denounce particularly the ordinary white Southerners instead of the white elites as idiots or, you know, inbred hillbillies and make jokes like that, you know, these are actually allies that you're alienating. So I want to make that clear.
Well, now, Joe Bajan wrote a very good book about, I don't know whether you read.
It's a brilliant book. It's brilliant.
Yeah, no, he really nailed it.
In fact, I've written defenses of white Southerners before, making the point that it's the political economic system.
Right, deer hunting
which,
with Jesus,
which many
I
of them are victims
yeah.
that you're against. And in response, I would get letters calling me Jethro, after the hillbilly TV characters. So there's, I don't want to stoke any snobbery, but it's clear that this is part of the Jefferson Jackson Confederate tradition, which the South was defeated in the Civil War, but in many ways the defeat of the South, it made it worse in terms of entrenching this political culture, because after the South was defeated, if you were for example, the 19th century, the early 20th century, if you're a Republican now, if you're a Democrat, you're allied with the foreigners, with the outsiders. You're a traitor to your region. And now this mentality is dwindling somewhat as the urban areas in the South expand and as it becomes more ethnically diverse, but it is a force in our politics, and it will be for some time.
And Michael Lind, again, who has an article at Salon.com called The Tea Party, The Debt Ceiling and White Southern Extremism. Clearly, they've exported the supermajority rules that came out of the Jim Crow era here to California, which has paralyzed the government here.
Well,
and they want to do that to the federal government, don't they?
Well, it goes back to John C. Calhoun, who was the great pre-Civil War statesman of the South, and when he realized the South was a minority in the federal government, he proposed a concurrent majority which would give the South a veto on all federal legislation forever. And essentially, without knowing it, and they've kind of, I don't think, they've consciously doing it, but they basically reinvented the same thing with this super Congress. Essentially, they've given a veto to the Southern-dominated Tea Party minority within the elected branches of the government.
And if they got their wish list, they'd have a constitutional amendment, which would be similar to what paralyzes the state of California.
Exactly.
Try and explain then, if you can, Michael Lind, what is going on with the president? Because I'm going to talk with James Carville about the lack of strategy, because he feels it from day one it's been a rout for the White House.
James may disagree with me. My own view is that just as a lot of today's Republicans were Democrats. They came from the right-wing segregationist wing of the Democratic Party, and then they converted to the Republican Party, like Rick Perry and Tom DeLay. Not that they personally are segregationists, but they came from that right wing of the so-called Dixiecrats. In the same way, I believe that Barack Obama is a Rockefeller Democrat. That is, he and many of his constituents, particularly in the Northeast and New England now, which have become solidly Democratic, their actual political ancestors are not the mid-century New Dealers of like Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson. But if you go back to people from that political region, it was Rockefeller Republicans. Now, they were very liberal. They were the most liberal people in the country on environmentalism, on race, on feminism, and on various social issues. But at the same time, the New Englanders and the Midwesterners, who used to be moderate Republicans, now they're centrist Democrats. They tend to be fiscal conservatives, and they were never terribly thrilled about Social Security under Roosevelt or about Medicare under Johnson. So I think that instead of treating Barack Obama as an inept Rooseveltian liberal, you should see him as a very successful Rockefeller Republican. And the goals of these Rockefeller Republicans who have captured the presidential wing of the Democratic Party, I think beginning with Carter and then increasingly with Clinton, their goal is to promote social liberalism like gay marriage and environmental policy and green energy and various other liberal social causes, and to combine it with moderate economic conservatism, not radical conservatism. They're not supply-siders. As I say, they're fiscal conservatives. Mm-hmm. But they want balanced budgets, and they want less spending. And it's a coherent combination of social liberalism and economic conservatism, but it is not progressivism.
Well,
only at the social side.
But your argument definitely gives another explanation to what just happened. But you're suggesting it wasn't ineptitude.
Both sides wanted it.
Yeah,
this is one place where the Dixiecrats and the Rockefeller Republicans agree.
Right.
They agree on cutting back Social Security and Medicare. They disagree about foreign policy to some degree, about gay rights, about abortion and other things. But the people who have been left out, you know, are the populists, the real populists in the South and West in particular, you know, who may be socially conservative, but they support New Deal programs like Social Security and Medicare, and also the genuine progressives.
Well, both of those blocks voted in 2008. So are you suggesting that Obama's a hoax?
No, I think that basically progressives made the wrong deal beginning in the 1970s and 80s, because the parties were then in flux with the Republicans losing their the Democrats losing their conservative wings, Northeasterners moving into the Democratic Party. The liberals had a choice. They could have a progressive populist alliance, but that would mean teaming up with a lot of people who don't believe in evolution but support Social Security and Medicare. Because let's remember, there would have been no New Deal and no Great Society without a lot of Southern populists who were quite conservative, and in many cases racist. Mm-hmm. You don't want them. But they were quite religiously conservative and socially conservative, but who supported Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson. So you could have had a progressive populist alliance and marginalized the Southern conservatives and the libertarians in the North. But instead, the progressives decided that issues like abortion, gay marriage, environmentalism were more important to them than these entitlements. And so what you thus have the alliance within the present Democratic Party between what I'm calling the Rockefeller Democrats, who are economic conservatives or libertarians, and the progressives. And what holds the Democratic Party together is agreement on social issues and environmentalism and civil rights. But they disagree about economics. And since the big money is on the moderate conservative side, the social liberals basically, as long as they get things like gay marriage, for example, or gays in the military, and I'm in favor of all of these things, I'm a progressive, mm-hmm. right? But I'm just saying, this is what happens. You know, the picture would be radically different if in the 70s and 80s and 90s the Democrats had decided, you know, we're going to write off all of those socially liberal, economically conservative former Republicans in the Northeast, and we're going to split the South and try to win over the creationists who support Social Security and Medicare.
Well, just in closing then, Michael Lind, since race played a huge part, obviously, in the Civil War and in when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1965, he said ruefully that this will be the end of the Democratic Party in the South, and it became a Republican Party, or the Republicans, in fact, are a Southern party, in effect. Race, of course, plays a part in the fact that we have first African-American president. Does that explain the contempt that they have for this man? I mean, it's not...
I think that's mistaken because... Yeah. Now, granted, you have a solid core of racists.
But you've got Mitch McConnell saying he wants this man to fail.
I think you have a short memory, Ian. I mean, ask James Carville. Yeah. They had utter contempt for Bill Clinton.
That's true.
You know, and they staged what was effectively, I call it a coup d'etat, you know, in terms of impeachment, attempted coup d'etat. What you have to understand is because the South was a one-party kind of police state up until the 60s, and I'm not exaggerating, you know, the states had their own secret police units, including my present Texas. They spied on people up until the 50s and 60s. I mean, it was kind of like South Africa. You got what in South Africa was called a logger mentality, right? It's our tribe, the white Anglo-Celtic Southern tribe, against the enemies within, blacks, Latinos, liberals, and the enemies without, the rest of the country. And because of that mentality, you get something very interesting. If you look at self-description in terms of ancestry by Americans, in the Northeast and Midwest, people put down English, European, you know, or German, Irish, Polish, and so on. There's this whole area of the South where people just say American, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, we know they're largely Scots, Irish, and British in descent. But that tells you something. They consider themselves just the Americans. Everybody else is hyphenated, right? Mm-hmm. The white Southerners are the real Americans. And those people, you know, those Italian Americans in New York and the German-American Lutherans in the middle, they're not real Americans. So I think it's much deeper than simply racism. It's this idea that, now, of course, you know, the joke in New York was that people who live in New York think people who live elsewhere can't be taken entirely seriously, right?
So parochialism, New Yorker cartoon, right?
There must be something wrong with you.
Right.
So parochialism is not unique to the South, but I do think there's this sense that, and you know, I'm from that background. You know, my fellow white Southerners see themselves as representing the true principles of 1776, notwithstanding the Civil War.
So,
and that tradition is under attack, and so they despise whoever, you know, the leader of the opposition is, be it Obama or Clinton or anyone else.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com called The Tea Party, The Debt Ceiling, and White Southern Extremism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with James Carville. Southern man.
Alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by James Carville, political strategist and CNN contributor. For some time, James Carville, you've suggested before the economic hostage crisis resulted in what people say was a ransom payment. You were saying it was a rout. How long do you trace back this rout?
Well, it was evident from the get-go that the Republicans were willing to go to default to get what they wanted, and it was evident from the get-go that the president was going to give it to them. What I don't understand is why the White House embraced this. Sometimes the truth would actually work. If we had a choice between a bad plan that we didn't like, we already presented an alternate plan that we liked, or a default, we chose the lesser of two evils here. But now the Republicans own the economy. Now we need to have an election. Is whose plan you would prefer? Their plan, which clobbers the middle class, which clobbers people who are working, or my plan, which asks most fortunate Americans to chip in a little bit, that made some investments, and at the same time reduce the deficit. Why embrace something that you know is no good, that you know is going to hurt the economy, that you never wanted in the first place? It doesn't make any sense to me. They should have signed it and then run against it.
Well, given that it's happened, I mean, there's an expression here in America that's quite common, which is nice guys finish last. And there's a sense amongst Democrats that they got whipped, and a sense of triumph amongst Republicans, where you have John Boehner saying we got 98% of what we wanted.
My question to speak is, what's the 2% you didn't get?
And you can build on that?
No, but my point is that this is a horrible plan. It's actually going to harm the economy. And whoever owned this economy in 2012 is at a distinct disadvantage. Why does the president take credit for this plan as opposed to telling him it's a Republican plan? We don't want any part of this. That's what I don't understand. Yes, Spain had got 98% of what he wanted. They have 98% of the responsibility for this economy now. See what I'm saying?
I absolutely see what you're saying. I don't know how he can sell it, though, because isn't the president in charge? Isn't he running on his record?
Doing, again, they were willing to use the debt ceiling to attain political ends and were willing to have the United States default for the first time in history. That was the lesser of two options. Why doesn't the president say that he has an alternate plan, just like Harry Truman ran against the do-nothing Congress in 1948, he can run against the do-the-wrong-thing Congress in 2012?
Well,
someone just
The problem with this, James Carville, is that you're not doing strategy at the White House, and I wonder who is, because, for example, your old boss, President Clinton, said, why not invoke the 14th Amendment, which was set up after the Civil War because there was a concern that the Dixiecrats could take over the Republican Party and cancel the Civil War debt, and therefore they put it into the Constitution that you couldn't mess around with the debt ceiling for political purposes, which is exactly what they're doing. Now, not only did the president not take that option, he took it off the table.
Yeah, he said up front that he was taking it off the table, and then at the end they said no, he was prepared to use it. And by the way, not only did he take it off the table, he said his lawyers told him it was unconstitutional. Well, why would anyone go and say what my lawyer said? So you're hearing a lawsuit, and you said my lawyers told me I shouldn't do this, but I did it anyway. Well, that's not a very advantageous thing. You know, it's been remarked by someone that if Obama was playing strip poker, he'd show up in a Speedo.
But James Carville, how do you revive this party and its sense of defeat against a party that clearly has a scorched earth policy? Is this a cultural difference?
Why don't we say we know what they have done? Their plan is in effect. This is a John Boehner's America. Uh-huh. Why don't we present an alternative? Why are we asking the middle class, people who vote Democratic, to pay for people who vote Republicans' excesses? Why are they paying for wars and tax cuts and credit default swaps and tranches and everything else? That's what caused all of this.
I know, and I think that there's also a moral dimension here that could be used in an argument is why impoverish millions of your fellow Americans for some bizarre ideological mechanism? The real world cost of what they've done, this is what I don't understand. It's almost like the president signed a suicide pact. He's going to be running on a defeated economy.
Not only that, and again, it was their idea. It was 98% John Boehner's economy now, if you believe John Boehner.
Right.
I do. It also, in the end, this is going to cost you. This is not only is this not going to save and drive a nickel off the deficit, it's going to cost, because the increased borrowing cost, now that everybody has figured out that in the United States, Congress is willing to use the debt ceiling to achieve political ends, and this time was to decimate working people, the next time it might be to end abortion or anything that comes up. They're going to demand a premium for this. There was a technical default in 1979 that cost us 0.6 interest rate. On the interest rate, according to finance professors, a 1/10 is $130 billion in additional borrowing costs. This is going to cost us money. It's going to save a nickel off this. It's hideous policy.
Well, is there a Pavlovian component here in our politics? How quickly do they have to feel the pain before they get motivated? Because the one statistic that I always keep in mind is that in 2008, 140 million people voted in this country and it swept Obama and the Democrats in. 2 years later, in 2010, only 75 million voted. It's you can't be a bunch of whiners and complain that they've taken you to the cleaners if you don't vote.
Well, I think, but again, people need to be motivated to vote, and they weren't motivated. They got to see somebody standing something, you know, in being about something, and we're not doing that right now. But the Pavlovian effect here is they're calling my flight. If I don't go, I'm going to miss it.
Sure.
Call me again. Okay.
Well, let's talk again. I appreciate the time we had. Thank you. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with James Carville, about to catch a plane. He's a strategist from the Clinton administration and a contributor to CNN. And that's all the time we had. Obviously, his plane got called. Joining us now is Amy Verdun, who is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Responses to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She is also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Verdun.
Hi, thank you.
And today, the financial markets went haywire. The Swiss franc rose more than it has in 36 years against a lot of currencies. Obviously, the currency markets are concerned about U.S. economic recovery, which they consider to be in jeopardy, and the European debt crisis worsening. What is your... looking at it from abroad and having studied European economies, what I don't understand about the contrast here is that the Greek situation is largely due to the fact that they don't have their own currency and that they're part of the Eurozone, whereas the United States is the reserve currency of the world. It has the ability to in effect, be the bank, and nobody's ever called them, and they issue debt all the time. And recently, we've had this extraordinary eruption of nativism in the U.S. Congress, where the Tea Party Republicans have been telling the world, don't buy our T-bills. So the contrast couldn't be greater, to my mind.
Yes, well, I've been speaking to this in the last couple of weeks when I was still in Europe for a couple of months for research with some colleagues, and asking ourselves exactly that question. Like, does the United States not understand that your financial markets and all of the financial actors will just go haywire if you're not speaking with one voice at a really crucial time? And I think one of the things we see in the United States is that sort of, you know, partisan politics seems to be trumping good governance for the country, when in all other countries where these difficulties come by, countries know that polar opposites will have to come together first and rescue the country. So I think it looks as if the United States just hasn't felt a real crisis in the way that some of the European countries are feeling today, and that they feel they can just have these issues all in sort of in light of upcoming elections and sort of getting a one-upmanship on another part of the party. So it's mind-boggling to see this from a distance.
But isn't it, I guess all the European analysts and the smart money around the world has figured out the obvious, that this deal is not going to do anything but make economic conditions worse.
Yeah, I think we haven't seen the end of this. And as I said, I think partisan politics is a real big thing here. I was also watching this sort of the standoff, and it seemed to me that the whole issue has been, how can one party position itself better than another party, rather than trying to solve the problem for the country right now in terms of needing enough funds to kind of deal with future spending and where taxes may or may not be coming from. So it's a bit of a, it doesn't seem to be very convincing, and you see the markets respond exactly in that way.
So just in terms of other shoes dropping, Amy Verdun, again, chair of the political science department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. It looks like the Dolce Vita is over in Italy, in the sense that they've already had an austerity package that went through some 57 billion. But of course, it doesn't take effect until 2013 and 14, after the national elections. But apparently on Wednesday, Berlusconi is going to have to ask for more budget cuts. And I guess the word is that this is different from Greece. Spain and Italy are considered too big to fail, also too big to bail.
Yeah. No, I think this is a really important point. Coming back to your opening comments regarding Greece, as much as the United States has its own currency and can do whatever it likes, and Greece does not, a lot of the difficulties we've seen in the run-up to the Greek crisis, and as you know, we had one in May of last year, and then again over the past couple of months we had the same issue all over again, isn't really necessarily the fact that the Greeks can't devalue at this point. Part of it is that they're part of economic and monetary union, which means that instead of having your own central bank, you now have a joint central bank. And instead of having the markets correct you and your currency fluctuating, the corrections now have to come through the real sector. And I think when it was Greece, a fairly small part of the euro area, it was fairly controllable. But everybody understands that if Italy, you know, the third or second largest economy of the euro area, would come down to the fence and wasn't able to deal with its debt, that they can't really bail Italy out, especially not if it's Italy and Spain together. So one of the real concerns at this point is, can Italy and Spain get their act together so that they really need not have to go to the fence on this one?
But this is already in a bond market where you have. I mean, it's worth pointing out that it's all these bailouts go to the bondholders, not to the people in economic distress. And it does seem incredibly unfair that irresponsible lenders don't get punished, but irresponsible borrowers do, even if they're governments that have been booted out by their own people, like the Greek conservatives.
Yes, this is indeed true. And one of the issues that has been playing up all along when the Greeks were in this situation was, to what extent should one let Greece fall? So should one allow what they call a haircut, so that when paying further funds or offering Greece below market rate interest rates, that some of the debts will have to be restructured, which basically means that those who hold debt would not get the same amount of money back on their investment. And those are the ones that you were talking about, bondholders, which may or be you and me and our, you know, people who control our pensions, so to say, and that could be all over the world. But typically, these are larger investors and not Joe in the street kind of thing. So I think what we do need to realize is that whatever package is cooked up for these countries needs to have those considerations. Having said that, what we've seen with the whole financial crisis from 2007, 2008 onwards is that if one doesn't look after these big financial affairs, that the entire economy comes down. In that sense, finance and money is a special part of the economy, which is one of the reasons why people were very critical of letting a big player like Lehman Brothers go bankrupt, because you can't just take out one player and assume that the economy is going to be just fine and that those who are holding those shares would just kind of, you know, put up with it. You know, it's risk to you. So having Greece go, or Spain or Italy, isn't necessarily good for the average day person. So finding the right balance is really important. And in the recent bailout that we've seen for Greece, the second one of $109 billion of euros in the past, last week or 2 weeks ago, on the 21st of July, there was that point, that sort of 20% of all of the new money would come from the private sector. And I think this is in response to these issues that you've raised.
Well, Angela Merkel has been saying that for some time, that the public shouldn't have to take, the German public shouldn't have to pay when, you know, the banks should pony up more. But at this point, it seems, Amy Verdun, that not only do you have Berlusconi addressing the Italian parliament on the economy on Wednesday to call for more budget cuts, Spain's Prime Minister Zapatero apparently delayed his vacation because economic indicators are not good, and investors are demanding a premium of 4 percentage points over benchmark German bonds to lend Spain for 10 years. And the spread for Italy late Tuesday stood at 3.5%, which is more than double where it was a month ago. So they're fighting the markets, and the markets are ruthless.
You're totally right. I think one of the things that this whole crisis has taught the Europeans is that as much as Europe over the past 10 years has done something that we understand from our American friends, right? The Europeans do this at the European versus member state level. So if you're in a political situation and you want to have a one-upmanship on somebody, you just target the European Union. So you say, oh, we don't want this. It's all Europe out there. And so a lot of this sort of speaking for your own country and then against either other countries or the EU is making a very divisive image of what the EU is all about, whereas in fact they're all rooting for the same team and they're just trying to appease some of their local population voters, trying to look good. This is now becoming very, very costly. And I think the situation where Italy and Spain are in now are very domestically, politically difficult. And the European Union as a whole is also not necessarily speaking with one voice. And the new IMF chief said this just a couple of days ago in the Financial Times, just saying, you know, it's really important that they speak with one voice. And so they need to coordinate and give the right signal, or markets are just going to go all over the place. And I think that's what we've been seeing just today, but also in the recent 3 or 4 or 5 weeks running up to all of this.
Well, Amy Verdun, a lot of analysts have argued that there was a whole year of dithering about the Greek situation until they really focused on it, and by which time it had gotten pretty much out of control. And I'm just wondering now, just in closing, are they going to get on top of this, or is this debt crisis that's in these individual countries that we've been talking about, could it grow into a serious threat to the Eurozone and the currency system?
Yeah, I think we're already at a serious threat to the euro area. I think this has been made this point has been made time and again. If one talks to those who are close to the bargaining table, they still don't have that scenario on the table. When they were talking about the Greek situation at the end of July and trying to solve that, the various scenarios on the table had to do with exactly how you value this and partial restructuring and all of that. There was no serious on-the-table conversation about euro area breakup and all that, but everybody knows it's in the background and that if it gets out of hand, that could be a scenario that suddenly would be on the plate. And so, yeah, there is a serious risk. I do think the political support from all of the different political directions in many of the countries doesn't want to go there, would not be motivated to have that happening as one of the solutions. So I think this situation now in Spain and in Italy will just speed up the urgency and make the importance more heightened than it would have been in sort of a week or two ago. So I think the awareness is there. And the question is if they have sufficient amount of leadership to speak with one voice, be creative, and be sure that they're averting these difficult times. And I think everybody's aware of the problems, and it's at what point are they so serious that they'll start speaking with one voice and be more focused on solving the problems in a more long-term fashion.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Amy Verdun.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Again, I've been speaking with Amy Verdun, who is Chair of Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Responses to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She's also co-editor of Journal of Common Market Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of Age of Greed.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Don't ask, what for? Gimme, I need some more. Gimme. Don't ask, what for? Gimme, I need some more. Gimme. Don't ask, what for?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. Jeff Madrick is a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst. He currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times, in addition to other publications. He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as Taking America, The End of Affluence, and The Case for Big Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Ian, it's good to speak to you.
And even the day after when the enemies of big government were so triumphant.
What? Well, it's tough on the enemies of big government include so many Democrats, as well as the president. It's pretty aggravating. It's one of this debt ceiling confrontation is one of the great political follies of our history, and it can only jeopardize what is already a weak economy. So we may be in for some rough waters. May have avoided one iceberg. There are a lot more icebergs out there, I'm afraid, that we'll be running close to.
Well, the Republicans want icebergs. They want them lined up. They want to be able to do this more often. And what I don't understand is how the president either got himself into the position or was forced to agree to something that's really going to damage his chances of being reelected, because his best hope was economic recovery. And these economic illiterates and nativists almost threatened the entire economy and were prepared to bring it down. And now their policies are going to absolutely kill the recovery.
I think it's hard to believe some of them, anyway, did not know what they were doing. It would be hard for me to believe most of them actually knew what they were doing, which is to box the president in. So they win either way. They win if their austerity economic theory, that is cut government spending, and uncertainty and business will just bounce back. They win if that works, but they win if it fails, and it's going to fail, and the economy does poorly. How does the president win with 8.5% or 9% unemployment rate in an economy that's going sideways at best and maybe going down again? So the president's an awfully bad chess player. What bugs me a lot more, however, is he was playing politics, as you well know, and I know you've talked about a lot, trying to put himself in the center to look like the reasonable guy, and sacrificing us and the economy in the process.
Well, but we had James Carville on earlier on the program, and he said that the biggest mistake President Obama is making is that he signed off on a deal that got his that he's sharing billing on this disaster that Boehner claims he got 98% of what he wanted, but the president has his fingerprints all over it, and he owns this as much as Boehner does, and Carville doesn't understand why the president from day one just said, okay, well, if this is what I've been forced into signing, I'm signing it to stop the economy from being destroyed, but this is a disaster and I in no way support it. And yeah, start to run for 2012, but he's clearly not doing that. So what's going on? Is he a Rockefeller Democrat, as Michael Lynn said in the opening segment?
I think maybe in his heart of heart he's a moderate, maybe even right of center, maybe doesn't really believe in government the way some of us do, and he should. But I think they did make a political calculation, and I think it's a bad one. I think they believed that the 2010 elections were lost by the Democrats because the American public thought their problems were caused by big government spending, and they were going to take another position. I think they're totally wrong. They lost the election because Americans were scared they were going to lose their jobs, which they were losing. There is more job displacement, in other words, people losing their jobs permanently than ever before. We're not getting unemployment down. As we know, we may be sinking again. And he never seemed to understand that there was a jobs crisis there. Nor, I think, did his economists right from the beginning. Now, he doesn't have any seriously prominent economists because they're not even making decisions in the White House. But they didn't help that much beforehand and indeed did a fair amount of harm.
So, Jeff Madrick, in terms of age of greed, there are clearly the fingerprints of the Koch brothers, of Dick Armey and of Karl Rove, on the creation of the Tea Party, which in many ways is a fiction and a hoax. It's the repackaging of the right wing of the Republican Party. Our first guest, Michael Lynn, says it's actually the Southern angry white Southern rejectionists that essentially make up the bulk of the caucus, by the way, in the House, which of course he's quite right on. But just try and explain, if you can, if there's an explanation for this puzzlement that I have, that the Koch brothers are able to mobilize the anger of people who found their standard of living declining and channel it into a campaign to make conditions worse for the people. And here they are, out demonstrating, demanding less tax from billionaires and worse health, education, and social security for themselves.
Well, I do think, and the age of greed, this is one of the major themes of my book, Age of Greed. There was a change in the nation in the 1970s. Americans panicked under the extreme weight of high inflation and high unemployment back in the 70s. And then there was a certain amount of successful propaganda coming out of the economics profession from the politicians. Every time the deficit would go up, they would scream government. Every time inflation would tick up, they would scream it was government's fault. Most of it was untrue, but I believe Americans began to turn against government in that period. And then business started organizing itself to lobby effectively. Think tanks began, wealthy people began giving a lot of money to right-wing think tanks, and they kept the pressure up on simple ideas and mythologies about our history.
Milton Friedman was a leader of mythologizing our economic history, but there were others, not least of them Ronald Reagan. And unpredictably, for me, it has stuck. But we have to know, understand one thing historically. Americans don't become progressive in the worst of times. The New Deal makes us think that. But the progressive periods occurred during periods of more prosperity for economies, when people began to realize they had rights and prospects and could fight back. So it's not that odd historically that people are betting against their own interests. It's complicated. I don't want to give simple answers, but it's not that odd. But it's about time the media and the American people themselves began to understand what's going on here. Government spending is not destroying this economy. Let me repeat
well,
that.
Well, no,
it's not destroying this economy.
Nor
very
are taxes,
the
by
opposite.
The way. Nor are taxes. I mean, the United States is taxed about 34th in the world in terms of its taxation to GDP. But just in closing, then again, Jeff Madrick, author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the present. It seems to me that also Keynesianism has taken a huge hit. I had Jeffrey Sachs on the other day, and he was railing against Krugman and this whole notion that there wasn't enough of stimulus. He said the stimulus itself was ridiculous, all this shovel-ready stuff. There was nothing about infrastructure. And he's basically saying that the problem is that we haven't had a leader that set out a proper economic a debate about not so much being defensive about big government. As you say, that was the lesson that they mislearned from 2010. He's saying, how about having a debate about better government? How about having a debate about, you know, getting what do you get for your taxes as opposed to how much tax do you pay? And that, what do you think
well,
of that?
That's a reasonable point, but I think, let me count the ways Jeff Sachs has been wrong in his life. the long, long decline of Poland before it came back, the horrible consequences in Russia. I think Krugman is basically right about the need for a stimulus, but I think Sachs has a point. I think if Obama had one obligation, one priority as president, it should have been to tell Americans, show Americans and teach Americans what government can do and why it's necessary and vital to prosperity and social justice. And I don't think that was anywhere in his mind. I believe it must have been when we all voted for him, but I sure don't believe it was in his mind then, nor do I believe it is in his mind now. It is vital for Americans to begin to understand the purposes and needs and potential of government, and there's nobody teaching them this. This man, Obama, refuses to take the lead in educating Americans. They look at the polls, they interpret them the way they want to interpret them, and then they try to get themselves elected. And that's why we're in this horrendous fix today, when we're literally cutting government spending at a time when we may be falling into recession. It's hard to believe.
And he's also, rather than making a case for government, he's joining the other side in making government a part of the problem.
It's hard to even call him a Rockefeller Republican, a Rockefeller Democrat. Yeah. I think Rockefeller would not have taken these stands, putting Medicare up for reductions in Medicare and raising the eligibility age, when in fact what we need really is Medicare for all or some system like that. So it's pretty discouraging. One thing people should know is on the tax issue, and I believe you're perfectly right, taxes are low in America. We can solve any future deficit problem quite easily by taxing ourselves properly. But the Bush tax cuts were supposed to lead to rapid economic growth, and they led to the slowest growth from 2001 to 2007 before the catastrophe of any similar period in the post-World War II period.
Well, Jeff Madrick, I thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to speak to you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the present. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out talking with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com, The Tea Party, the Debt Ceiling, and White Southern Extremism. And he believes, of course, that the mainstream media have missed the story of portraying the Tea Party as an ideological rather than a regional movement. And while Michelle Bachmann and Joe Walsh may be the face of the party, the majority of its members in the House of Representatives are white Southern men. And he makes the case that this is all a part of its tradition of the white Southerners, their hostility to the North, their sense of betrayal about the Civil War, and that they are, you know, essentially still fighting the war, and they're prepared to fight it as guerrillas and to use the kind of ruthless tactics that the Tea Party have exhibited. He then went on to say that Obama is not, everybody talks about Obama's strategy being so poor. He says, no, Obama got exactly what he wanted because this is what he does want. He's a Rockefeller Democrat, he says. You know, he's liberal on social issues, but fiscally conservative and essentially agrees with a lot of the package, which is may come as a deep shock to a lot of people. James Carville then followed him, and he argued that as bad as a strategist Obama may have been, that he's got a golden opportunity here to run against Boehner, because Boehner says he got 98% of what he wanted. Well, now it's the Boehner economy. And just as Harry Truman ran against a do-nothing Congress, Carville thinks that Obama should run against the all-cuts, no-taxes on the billionaire Boehner Congress. And, you know, he's mystified as to why Obama agreed to this deal. Not so much that he agreed to it. He could have said, I had to agree to it. It was, I had a gun to my head, otherwise the entire economy would have crashed. But that would be the moment to say this is the Republican economy. This is what they've done, and begin to run against it. So I guess in a sense he's still saying that Obama is a terrible strategist. And then we spoke about the European currency crisis, which just happened today with a lot of the currencies around the world crashing, speculators rushing into the Swiss franc, a sense that the American economy is not going to improve, and that Italy and Spain are starting to show signs of going the way of Greece. And we talked a lot about how serious that was and whether or not in the end that the Europeans could grasp the seriousness of the situation, since they dithered for so long over the Greek situation and only dealt with it by the time it became a huge crisis. She ultimately thinks they can get their act together, although clearly the clock is ticking, and The Spanish Prime Minister had to cut off his vacation. The bond markets are just pounding Spain, and they're pounding Italy as well. Finally, we talked with Jeff Madrick, the author of Age of Greed, which seemed to be a very appropriate book, given that greed has triumphed over governance in these last few days. And he believes in many ways that this is the suicide pact that Obama signed, that the economy will be destroyed by these austerity measures, and that Obama will be running against this economy. And it is pretty hard to understand that reasoning, but that's what we have, and that's today. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.